Today on Straight Talk Africa, the challenges of consolidating democracy in two West African nations of Nigeria and Senegal. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheka Sali, and today we are talking about the upcoming presidential elections in Nigeria and Senegal. At least 10 African nations are expected to hold general elections in 2019, according to the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. What's really at stake as these countries use the ballot box to deepen the quality of democratic governance? My colleague Paul Ndiho has more.
Tens of millions of people are expecting to vote in more than 10 African nations in 2019, according to the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES, a Washington, D.C.-based independent organization that supports citizens' right to participate in free and fair elections in more than 145 countries. Nigerian voters were scheduled to cast their ballots in the nation's presidential and parliamentary elections on February 16th. But just 5 hours prior to the polls opening, the country's Independent National Electoral Commission announced a one-week delay in the vote to Saturday, February 23rd. The commission blamed logistical difficulties, including problems in distribution of ballots and result sheets, as well as sabotage, after three fires at its offices in the last 2 weeks.
We believe that ultimately this decision is good for our democracy and for our country. I wish to assure you of our commitment to free, fair and credible elections.
Two main political parties swiftly accused each other of orchestrating the delay as a way to manipulate the vote, a sentiment echoed by some voters, many of whom had traveled long distances to vote in their hometowns. Political observers are predicting a tight race between incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari and chief challenger, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar. Buhari, 75, has been in office since 2015. In Senegal, voters head to the polls on February 24th, where incumbent President Macky Sall is facing four other primary challengers. President Sall, 57, was first elected in 2012. Two opposition leaders, a former Dakar mayor Khalifa Sall and ex-minister Karim Wade, were barred from running due to previous convictions for misuse of public funds. Thousands of supporters of both former candidates have staged protests in recent months calling for fair and transparent elections. The former French colony is seen as a model of democracy in the region, having never experienced a coup and successfully staging peaceful transfers of power in 2000 and 2012. Stakes are high in South Africa as voters gear up for general elections on May 8th. The ruling African National Congress Party, ANC, is looking to reverse its declining popularity due to weak growth, unemployment and corruption. The opposition has latched onto ANC's corruption as an election trump card. The ANC is facing a tough fight to retain its dominance and proposing constitutional changes to address land right issues. The far-left South Africa Economic Freedom Fighters Party has land exploration and jobs at the top of its election agenda. Malawians are expected to cast their ballots in tripartite elections on May 21st. Voters will select a president, members of parliament, and local councillors. The election pits incumbent President Peter Mutharika of the Democratic Progressive Party against his former Vice President Saulas Chilema. Political observers say Chilema is seen as the biggest threat to Mutharika. Meanwhile, former President Joyce Banda has also joined the race after reversing a decision to join an alliance with the opposition. political analysts say her announcement could be a game changer. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Joining us in the studio are three distinguished guests. Ambassador Robin Renee Sanders, former ambassador of the United States to Nigeria. Aliyu Mustafa, managing editor of VOA's Hausa Service. And Idris Farr from VOA's French to Africa unit. From Nigeria, we are joined by VOA's Grace Alheri Abdu. And from Senegal, we are joined by VOA executive producer Sarwa Jafali. I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the five of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Let's go to Dakar, the Senegalese capital. Good evening, Sarwa.
Hello, Shaka.
How are you?
Very good.
What is the mood like in the land of what I call the land of Ousmane Sembene, father of African cinema?
Well, I've been here since Monday, and I can definitely say that the tension is growing as we approach Election Day. I've been driving through town yesterday and today, and people are holding rallies. They're meeting each other in their streets. They're trying to rally people in their neighborhoods. They're chanting support of their candidate, their favorite candidate, but they're also insulting them in the most blunt way, the candidates they don't like. So the tension is definitely growing. Yesterday, I've been on the main street here, the Corniche Street, and it's full of billboards. There are billboards of candidates everywhere. And what was interesting is that most billboards were vandalized, mostly the four candidates, except those of Macky Sall. I'm not saying that Dakar supports Macky Sall 100%. I'm sure if you go to Thiès, for example, the turf of Idriss Sasek, you'll find the same way, you know, pictures of Macky Sall destroyed. So tension is everywhere. People are expecting the elections. Local news are covering the elections, of course. Yesterday, I watched the news bulletin of the public channel here, RS1, and they were showing report after report, reassuring people that the ballots have been distributed, that everything is ready for the electors to go and vote in the most peaceful way. There was like three governors giving their statement saying that security will be assured, and they dispatched police and soldiers to make sure that everything is going to be all right. What's interesting, Shaka, yesterday is I was watching, and maybe one of your guests, Idriss Fall, can help me with this. So I was watching, and all of a sudden, in the middle of all these reports, there was a report on former President Abdoulaye Wade, and the whole report was basically praise of Abdoulaye Wade. As you know, Abdoulaye Wade is a former president. He came back to Senegal last week to call everybody to not go and vote, to boycott the election. He also said something about burning the ballots. And here in the middle of a news bulletin in public channel, you have praising of this figure, this public figure. So maybe Idriss can help me with that, but that was interesting. The other thing, well, there's been some violence a couple of weeks ago, one death and many injured, but since then there's been nothing major happening in the country. Macky Sall, as well as the other candidates, have been calling people to calm down and to make sure that they go to vote for their favorite candidate. So we'll see for whom they're going to vote in a couple of days.
Now, sir, we know, of course, that Macky Sall has really been a good leader, someone that has governed his country, at least according to a lot of people, very well. But what about the emergency of the person that seems to be a rising star? I'm talking about Ousmane Sonko. Is he drawing, is he to a certain degree drawing traction?
Well, he is, in the sense that, well, for starters, he managed to collect the 53,000 signatures necessary for his sponsorship, which was a surprise. I mean, he's a young man. He's 44 years old. He's never been minister before, unlike the other candidates. He's been a public servant for years, but he's been sacked because he published a book criticizing Macky Sall and his entourage and accusing him of corruption. And since then, he's run for to be a member of parliament, which he is since last year. So young people like him because he's kind of a fresh air. I mean, the rest of the candidates are kind of older. We've seen them before. Most of them have worked with former President Abdoulaye Wade. So this Sonko is kind of a new thing. And he uses social media. He's connected to what's going on. Don't forget that I think like more than 80% of Senegal's population is under 40 years old. So people want change. So these young people, they want to see new faces. I can't say for sure that he's going to win this election. Nobody knows. And as you know, polls are forbidden during this period of time. But let me remind you of this survey that's been done by public, private, organization, Senegalese organization in November, that gave Macky Sall 45 chance of winning. After him, there's Idrissa Seck, and then Souleymane Sonko.
I see.
Ousmane Sonko.
Well, on that note, thank you very, very much, Sarwa, for your briefing.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you, Ambassador Robin. I'm sure you know Macky Sall well, and Macky Sall has really been, by all indications, a very good leader. Do you think there is a chance that people in Senegal will probably be voting for Macky Sall for a second term, or are they probably going for change?
I think that, I don't presuppose what voters are going to do. Because everything on the ground will drive how voters are going to determine who they're going to support. I think that from the perspective here in the United States, we think that Macky Sall has done a very good job in terms of opening up dialogue, the development process, trying to move Senegal forward. But I've learned from years of being an election observer that never presuppose what voters are going to do at the polls if it is a free, fair election that has an even playing field for everyone.
Let me come to you, Aliyu Mustafa. You've had, of course, Salwa on the ground. Do you get the sense that people in Senegal are going to be voting for issues, or are they in fact going to be voting for personalities?
You know, I agree with Ambassador Sanders. Elections are terribly unpredictable. It's also dangerous to actually predict what can happen because it might not happen. Senegal is one of those African countries that have enjoyed relative peace and stability compared to other countries on the continent. You know that. And every time a leader is able to keep the country together and maintain peace and order, he gets credit for that. And but it doesn't mean that that's our opinion over here. We don't know what the people in Senegal are thinking or saying, but politics is... it's a system where people differ in their opinions and perceptions. No matter how good a leader is or what good work they are doing, it's always likely that somebody somewhere is seeing something different. It's like trying to assure someone it's daylight and somebody insists it's nighttime. So, but given the fact that this current leader has been able to do well economically and socially, from our perspective, it's likely that he might prevail, but it's not a guarantee.
I see. It is far. You come from Senegal.
Yes.
Senegal is a great country. It has. It used to have a founding president, Leopold Seda Senghor, a man who was one of the fathers of negritude.
Yes.
A man who was an artist, to boot. And in fact, at one time, he was rumored to probably, at one time, could have won a Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yeah, he was a member of the French Academy of and I think all the Senegalese now we have a lot of respect for Senghor because he ruled the country about 20 years and decided by himself to leave the power.
And he was, by the way, if I recall correctly, the chief grammarian of the French Parliament.
Absolutely.
During colonialism.
I think during the Second World War, him, Aimé Césaire, Léon Gontard Damas, they contributed to bring respect of the black people there.
They fight. Yes, it did.
Besides that, I think Senegalese, they respect him a lot because he contributed to open the democracy, because it's through him he decided to install multipartism in Senegal. He became with three parties, and then when he left power, the guy who replaced him, Abdou Diouf, come and open completely.
The tallest president in the world.
Yes, even taller than the basketball players. And Abdou Diouf opened old co-warner have, I think right now we have around 300 political parties.
Yes.
Some of them very teeny. We call them cabin telephonic parties.
Yes.
And Abdou Diouf himself, he was beaten by Abdoulaye Wade. It was the first transition Pacific through election where Senegalese went and get rid of one president. It was Abdou Diouf. Abdoulaye Wade came to power.
And he has, of course, the distinction of having conceded defeat.
He called him that night and tell him that you lost and then gave him power. He went to Paris and was head of the Francophonie for years. Now he's back in Senegal taking care of his grandkids and things like that.
You also, of course, have the distinction of having produced Cheikh Ant Diop, the great intellectual, the man who said the Egyptian pyramids had Negroid features and
still
therefore
there.
Could probably
they are
have
still
been lived
there.
By Africans.
They're still there because I think Cheikh Ant Diop did a lot of research to say that the first civilizations were black, that Egypt, the Egypt of Pharaoh, were black. And in Nation Negre et Culture, he contributed to elevate the way the colonizers was trying to show black people and the diaspora for his work. Until now, you have Pan-Africanists celebrating him, because he gave back to us what belonged to us, really. We are the diaspora, and we were the first civilization on Earth. We did a lot of things that people can't see until now when you go to Egypt, when you go to Ethiopia, and when you go to Sudan. That part, I think, helped Senegal a lot, because they have great intellectuals. I heard you talking about Ousmane Sembène.
Ousmane Sembène, of course, the father of African cinema.
African cinema.
I had the honor to be taught by him in the 1980s at UCLA Film School.
Well, that guy, we have a personal relation because I was a pipe smoker when I was younger. And whenever I will come back from Paris, I will bring him a pipe. And most of the pipe that guy you will see.
Really?
Yeah, I will bring him those pipes.
The author, of course, of many books, including the classic God's Bits of Wood.
Absolutely. And then later we came back in 2000, that guy, Abdoulaye Wade, also beat Abdou Diouf through
the
electoral
correct.
Process. But in 2012, himself, he was beaten by the actual president, Macky Sall.
And he too conceded defeat. With grace.
Yes, he had to. Because
now, do you think that we're going to look at an election, frankly, that is driven or based on personalities or issues, especially given that the last time I checked, there is a very, very serious shortage of water in your country?
Yes, but what's surprising, I called my mom, she's still there. I say, you don't have water. Why are you going to vote for this guy? They are working. The water going to come. So what can we answer about that? Yeah, and my mom.
We're talking about 4 million people, apparently.
She live in a town called Rufisque, and I call her, this guy is not bringing water. You're going to vote for her? Yes, it shows that they are working. And we see what they are doing right now. So but not the youth.
But talking about democracy, you obviously have a very good record in the sense that in addition to, for example, the founding father having actually stepped aside and handed over power peacefully, whereas in fact there are so many other countries on the continent where you have individuals saying that they cannot possibly leave power because if they did, those nations will probably collapse. You also have an incumbent president, Macky Sall, who has actually reduced the term, the years that a president could actually serve from 7 to 5.
Yes, because the constitution and the word was saying 5 years. Abdoulaye Wade changed it in because he wanted to run for a third mandate.
Yes.
And it did not work out because in 2012, Macky Sall beat him and he accepted graciously and went to Paris since then because he was very angry. His son was not allowed to run. He was condemned for stealing money. And after that, I think he was kind of not pardoned, but he lived in Qatar. And what I think of all these years never accepted that his son did not become president because the main issue people were discussing in 2012 was Mr. Wade want to run a third mandate to give the power to his son. And Senegal is not like Togo, I am sorry, it's not like Gabon, I am sorry.
Senegal is obviously is neither a monarchy nor a kingdom.
No, and I think
he's a very proud republic.
And people get rid of him. And he's still very angry because his son did not run. But all Senegalese know that Karim Wade, the son of Abdoulaye Wade, never won a single election in Senegal. He was beaten into his own neighborhood during local election in Dakar, in the neighborhood called Point E. He never won anything.
Interesting.
And the dad was so mad that after that loss, he decided he's going to appoint his son minister of the earth, the sea, and the sky. It's how Senegalese call him. And when I listened to press agencies presenting Karim Wade as a leader of the opposition, I say they don't know what they are talking about. At least the former mayor, I would say. But Karim Wade, no.
Very interesting. Let me come to you, Ambassador Robin Sanders. When you look at the democratic process on the African continent, you will agree with me that for some reason, the West African part of the continent seems to be doing reasonably well. The ECOWAS countries, when you talk about democracy, you seem to be doing very well in West Africa, especially when you compare with East Africa and North Africa. The second part of the region probably is Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. You served for several years in Nigeria as U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. What do you think is probably the secret behind that?
Well, I wanted to start by saying, you know, this is a year for African youth because the voters will primarily be young people across the continent. And so particularly in Senegal, particularly in Nigeria, and particularly for all of the 10 elections that are coming up. So I think that the dynamic shift that we are seeing, you know, in West Africa, we have some challenges, clearly, going forward. We have some challenges, of course, in East Africa, and we'll wait to see what happens in South Africa later in May. But I do think the shift is taking place because you have the bulk of the population, the young voters.
The young people, the changing demographics.
The changing demographics,
and
I think.
And probably some would say in tandem with social media.
Well, both things have to work together. And I think technology, social media, but the real desire, I work with a lot of young people, as you know, in the work that I do today, and this real desire for change, this real desire for a change in leadership, for younger leadership, to see the continent really live up to its potential. So I think that, you know, this is definitely a young voters election across the entire continent. And if you don't have the young voters with you, and I think they impact on whether or not people are voting for issues or development. because I think that if you're voting for personalities, that's one group of the electorate. But I think with the young people, they're looking for not only issues, but also change and development.
You're talking about young people voting and what have you, and that probably is assuming, as a matter of fact, that a lot of these countries indeed hold elections. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of evidence, in fact, that on the contrary, a lot of countries on the African continent hold selections, mm-hmm. not elections, mm-hmm. whose results, for example, would reflect the will of the people, mm-hmm. but in fact, that results tend to reflect the will of either the person who announces the vote mm-hmm. or the individuals who count the votes.
I think that you have to look at it country by country. I don't think that in this day and age, the cookie cutter approach works when you're looking at the continent. I do think you have to look at it country by country. Right now, you don't have the entire continent clearly having free, fair, and democratic elections. Okay, we know that. But I do think you need to look at it country by country. If I look at Ghana, for example, hopefully Senegal will have a free and fair election. We know that there are challenges right now in Nigeria in terms of what's going to happen, but their 2015 election was deemed free and fair. So I do think that we have to look at it country by country, and we also have to look at, you know, what the challenges are per country. And we, as on the developing world side, really have to do our best to support the free, fair, and transparent processes and really be supportive of those processes on the ground with stakeholders from the political parties, but certainly from civil society and certainly with voter education.
Aliyu, the reason I actually brought about West Africa, ECOWAS, you know, member countries seems to be doing much better than the rest of the continent, is sincerely because when you look at Senegal, for example, it should be one of those countries that you could probably classify as one of the beacons of hope for African democracy. You could add on Ghana. You could add on Benin. You could talk about other countries. Mm-hmm. When you go, on the other hand, you go to East Africa, it becomes very, very difficult for you even to get a single country. You can go, of course, Southern Africa. You have South Africa itself. You have Botswana. You have Namibia. You have a very good democratic record. When you go to Central Africa, it will be very difficult for you to actually even come up with probably one country. You go to North Africa, it is pretty much the same story. What is the secret behind West Africa in terms of democracy, really?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting that Senegal and Nigeria are having election almost at the same time, but I think somebody needs to settle an argument between these two countries about jollof rice.
It wasn't supposed to be like that. It's
I know,
only because something that was not supposed to happen happened in the land of the ogres, Nigeria.
But we have to settle the jollof rice issue at some point. But coming back to your question, I think we are watching a changing trend in Africa, on the continent generally. First of all, our leaders are getting a little bit younger than they used to be. I think with the...
Your leaders are getting younger than they used
well,
to be?
Well, let me come. I know some of them are still very old.
You're talking about President Muhammadu Buhari.
Hold on. Hold on, let me
You're
land.
Talking about one of the key contenders, Atiku Abubakar,
yes,
in Nigeria.
Okay, these two leaders in Nigeria have so much else, so much more in common. First of all, they are both Muslims. They are both from the north. They are both in their 70s. Atiku is 72, Buhari is 76. So if you consider, right from when Robert Mugabe stepped down or was forced to step down, somebody a little bit younger than him took over.
Really?
Isn't he younger than Mugabe?
Yes, younger than Mugabe, but relatively in the same league, really, because you can't possibly call Mr. Mnangagwa a young Turk.
Shaka, the point I'm trying to bring is the role youth play in our political systems these days. The advent of social media, the ability of the world to learn, to know things much faster than it used to. Even the systems of campaigns have changed tremendously over the years.
But that is not limited to West Africa.
No, I know, but it is also contributing to the changing trends that you are witnessing in Africa. Africa has certain common factors tying it to each other, but they are not really alike. If you divide Africa into two, between Francophone Africa and Anglophone Africa, the way things are done politically are not really the same way.
So if you take that route, what about Lusophonic Africa?
Right. Well, Africans are Africans anyway.
Well, that's why I say you can't do a cookie-cutter approach, basically. You really have to look at what's happening in each and every country.
Right.
And even the role that the judiciary has played negatively or positively in some countries. If you look at last summer, with the role that the judiciary played in the Kenyan election, having the Kenyan election to be redone. So
Round one and round two. But another round two, really.
But I think that's why I don't like the cookie cutter approach, because I think that the dynamics on the ground for each and every country is so drastically different.
Right.
The one thing I will say overall, though, is the role that the youth voters are going to play in all of the elections that are coming up.
Well, I have to say, time is not our best ally. Those guests of mine in the studio, let's go to Abuja, where my colleague Grace Alheri Abdu is standing by. Good evening, Grace. Good evening, Grace.
Hi, good evening, Shaka.
How are you?
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I am hugely terrific. What is the mood like on the ground in Abuja?
Nigerians are ready and eager to go to the polls come Saturday. You know, even after the postponement of the elections, you know, there were people thinking that a lot of people will be discouraged and either not go back to there are villages or places where they register to vote. But what we are hearing on ground is totally different, because I can see there's a lot of excitement. As a matter of fact, some of the political groups called on their members, if you already travel out of city, wherever you travel from, you should stay where you are until you cast your vote. And so if you go to offices, a lot of people are not back. They decided to stay back. And those that are able to come back, either to, for instance, people traveling out of Abuja to their respective states, those that were able to come back came back with the intention of either leaving tomorrow or on Friday. So I can tell you there's a lot of excitement about this election.
Now, talking about the excitement, Grace, what is driving the campaign? What has been driving the campaign so far? Has the campaign really been on issues? Have we talked about the Nile Delta, for example? Have we talked about unemployment? Have you talked about those types of things? Or is it about personalities?
I don't know whether to call it about personality or issues, but I can tell you, for one, I have seen a lot of young people determining to cast their vote for the first time, not that they just turned 18, but for whatever reason, they are gingered up and they are excited. And I've seen women group mobilizing other women to go to the polls. I know, for one, the candidate for People's Democratic Party, that is Alhaji Atiku Abubakar, has promised the youth and the women that if elected into office, he's going to give the women 30%. And he's going to give the youth 40% of all his cabinet positions. So I don't know whether for those that are supporting PDP, whether that is their driving force. But you know, President Muhammadu Buhari has been campaigning, one, on the intention to fight corruption, secondly, to boost economy, thirdly, to address the security problems. So I can tell you, both parties, the supporters of both parties are very, very gingered up, and they are doing everything possible to see that their candidate win the day.
What about the fact that President Muhammadu Buhari 4 years ago promised among other things that he was going to clean the Niger Delta. And the last time I checked, nothing really much has happened in the Niger Delta. Is that something that people are talking about?
I think for the most part, for those that are supporting the PDP candidate Atiku Abubakar, for the most part, that is their driving force, saying that President Muhammadu Buhari had made many promises that he is yet to fulfill. Talking about security, they are saying they are still facing security challenges. Talking about unemployment, they are saying they are worse off. Talking about poverty level, they are still talking about that. So those that are really supporting Atiku Abubakar, that is what they are holding on to say that President Muhammadu Buhari made so many promises that he is yet to fulfill.
Now, when you talk to people, and especially the young people that you are talking about and the women that you alluded to, what do they seem to say they will be voting for? Would they be voting, for example, for more of the same, or would they in fact be going to vote for change?
Well, for the young people and the women that I have talked to, as a matter of fact, VOA also hosted three different town halls, one for the youth, one for the women, and then we had one that we combined all stakeholders. For them, they are still saying, the women particularly are still saying that they are even worse off today than they were 4 years ago. They talked about during Obasanjo regime, they had almost 40% women positions in the cabinet, and they had very, very high and sensitive positions. You remember that Ngozi was Minister of Finance, you know. So they are saying that they are worse off because today they have fewer women going for elected positions, like very few women that got the nomination of their parties to run for federal electoral positions. They have very few women. As a matter of fact, we have just one woman that is deputy governorship candidate in the north. That is Ede from Benue State, the deputy governor for People's Trust. So they have very few women now than they had in the past. So they are saying that if they will have any candidate that will promise that there's going to be change, that is the candidate they are going for.
Thank you very much, Grace Abdu, for your insight. And good luck in your coverage of the elections in Nigeria.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Thank you very
much. You're tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, two major elections are coming up this weekend. On Saturday, Nigerian voters head to the polls to elect a president and a national assembly. On Sunday, Senegalese voters cast their ballots in a presidential election. An in-depth discussion on the Nigerian and Senegalese elections on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today, we are discussing the upcoming presidential elections in Nigeria and Senegal. Our guest, Ambassador Robin Green Sanders, former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, Aliyu Mustafa, managing editor of VOA's Hausa service, and journalist Idris Fall from VOA's French to Africa service. I have to say, lady and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very
much. You're most welcome. Let me come back to you, Robin. When we talk about Nigeria, that must be very, very familiar territory.
Yes, it's very, very familiar territory. I consider myself a friend of Nigeria, and I watch what happens there politically and economically quite closely.
Are you surprised that the election wasn't held last week?
I was surprised by the shortness in the time for postponement. I think that really, I don't get stunned that easily, but that one really shocked me, and I think it shocked a lot of people. I don't think the postponement per se was a shock, because they've had postponements in 2011 and 2015, but, you know, 6 hours or 5 hours before the polls open, I think that that really threw a lot of people. And I think as a result, you will see or are seeing already the stepped up rhetoric between the two main political candidates. You have some people that are worried about the credibility, or rather the credibility threshold is even higher now. Because you have the postponement, you've got the economic impact on the country. I've heard figures of half a day's GDP was lost, which is about $1.5 billion. You've got the challenge of getting voters back. I was really glad to hear your report from the field. But even with that, you'll have some attrition, where people that could not get back for various reasons. And so you're going to, even if you don't have apathy, you may have voter attrition. And so the key will be what happens on election day, whether or not people have confidence in the process on that day, given everything that's gone before. And then you will also have some challenges that we have to watch right after the election, to hopefully assume that if the process goes well and people have confidence in the results, that that will still lead to a peaceful process post-election. So those are some of the key challenges.
Aliyu, you come from Nigeria, the land of the ogres. Were you surprised about what happened last week?
I was, like the ambassador, devastated by the development, because of the very short amount of time between the announcement and the actual time of implementation, meaning when people were supposed to come out. I was watching television here in Washington, D.C. at about 9 p.m., which would have been 3 a.m. in Nigeria. At 3 a.m., probably 90% of Nigerians would have been asleep. The president himself came out in the morning shocked, just like Atiku was shocked. So he told me a few things. One, whatever made INEC take that decision must have been really big.
To what extent is INEC independent? To the extent that it is not subordinate, for example, to the resident of Asorok, the president.
Being a government parastatal, it cannot be 100% independent. But first of all, I have to give credit to both President Buhari and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar and INEC for their ability within a very short period of time to calm Nigerians a little bit too. It's like 4 or 5 days ago since this election was postponed. But within that short time, all the stakeholders, being the president and his ruling party, the APC, Atiku Abubakar and his PDP, and INEC, have gone really far in coming out on a daily basis to reassure Nigerians. In fact, I have a newspaper clip here that says, only God can stop Saturday. this is from INEC.
Very interesting.
So this kind of reassurances keep Nigerians hopeful, and it keeps things down too. It keeps the country relatively calm and at peace. The problem we have right now is the remark that President Muhammadu Buhari made 2 days ago about his concern for ballot snatching, and the remark that he made indicating that he had given his military commanders orders to deal quote unquote, ruthlessly with anybody found to be snatching ballot boxes, which the opposition is translating to be a shoot and kill order from the president. All sides have been trying to.
But normally, who would be snatching ballot boxes?
It's a very common practice.
Are they ordinary people or are they security personnel? Really?
They are supporters of both parties. This happens. This is a very common practice that takes place. Yes, it's a very common practice. It happens.
In Nigeria?
Yes. In Nigeria, it does
really?
Happen. Yeah, it does. It does happen.
Now, let me ask you this question to Aliyu. Normally, elections are postponed either a day before or days before or a week before, but not on the very day of voting, really.
As a
it seems
fact,
to be very, very unusual.
The last election in 2015 was postponed for months, mm-hmm. actually, not days.
But was it postponed on the exact date that people were supposed to vote? That's what I'm asking.
That is why Nigerians are still speculating as to why. And INEC has given the official reasons, as far as INEC is concerned, saying that logistical problems, the burning of certain INEC offices in some parts of Nigeria, and its inability to take things to all the locations where it was supposed to have taken them to, but these are usual issues. These are usual problems that electoral commissions usually face and confront almost every time there's an election. But right now, the election would have taken place from what we had on Tuesday, which would have been yesterday, but they decided that card readers had been programmed to work only on a certain day, meaning they needed time to make sure that the card readers were that they did some work on the card readers to make sure that they work on the next Saturday, because they were supposed to have just worked on the Saturday, the 16th of February. So now, like I'm saying, nobody knows. The problem is a lot of people were very disappointed, to the extent that some people say they are not coming out to vote. But I'm glad to hear Grace say that people are actually coming out to vote. That with the fear of this order that the president had apparently given to security agents, could affect the turnout. We don't know, but we're hoping that things would work out.
We're talking about at least 84 million potential voters here.
Yes.
What do you think was behind the incredible efforts of the INEC and the previous chairman? We're talking about Professor Atahiru Jega.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Well, I think that you bring up a very interesting point. My team and I worked with INEC, and so has every U.S. ambassador in the donor community and the Nigerian stakeholders. And a lot of time and effort and support for INEC has been there, helping INEC move forward over the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
And so what worries me, though, right now is that some of that confidence in INEC has been eroded just a bit. And the question is, can they regain it sufficiently enough for people to be comfortable with the outcome on Saturday? I'm hoping that Nigerians will, they're resilient. I never count Nigerians out on anything. And so I'm hoping that it will be peaceful. You'll have a respective amount of voters who turn out. You have, you're right, 84 million voters, but 42 million of them are young people.
Mm.
And we talked about the young voter issue earlier. And then the whole challenge of reconfiguring 180,000 card readers, the whole issue of the election materials moving back from the central bank, back out and being distributed back out into field. All that has to happen between now and Saturday, before Saturday, actually. And, you know, going back to the postponement issue, you know, we talked about 2011, 2015, early postponements. You know, nobody would have been surprised by that. What I don't really understand, though, say that all of these things were challenges, the weather, the logistics, reconfiguration, all of those challenges. What I don't understand is, did anybody take in voter outreach in that timing process? Because there would be no way at 5 hours before an election that you could reach 84 million registered voters to let them know the election has been postponed. So when they do their after action, they have to look at that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I do worry that as I said, don't count Nigerians out. I'm counting on the elections being credible and fair, but I also realize that now the threshold for INEC has been moved up a bit because of this last-minute postponement.
The chairman of ANEC was just out today reassuring people that the logistical problems they had last week had been generally overcome. They assured that most materials, electoral material or election-related materials, have already been delivered to most parts of Nigeria. So that part of the problem appears to have been resolved. The other part is to get people to come out to vote.
I'm not sure on that because they also said weather was a factor. And if you live in Nigeria and you live in the north, I've been to, you know, every state in Nigeria more than four or five times. This is always the weather in Nigeria. It doesn't change. You know, it's always going to be in the north. It's always going to be dusty and stormy and with dust storms. And so I heard that, you know, all of the materials have not yet been moved back.
Right. But the troops under Professor Atahiru Jega must have probably had pretty much the same conditions already.
Yeah, I think nobody is saying that the 5 hours postponement was comfortable. Nobody's saying that. Everybody was disappointed by that because you would think that the things that they listed, they saw early enough that they could have even done a week ahead postponement. So I don't think anybody's arguing that fact. But I think moving, we've got to go past that. That's happened. We've got to look at what happens coming Saturday.
You remember, Aliyu, that even 4 years ago in Abuja, in the tallying center,
I remember that drama.
You remember Orubebe?
Yes, I remember the drama, yes.
He nearly caused problems.
He almost did, but Jega was calm.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Jega remained calm and you know, stood his ground and things just worked out. Like the ambassador says, this is what Buhari himself was saying. He said, I cannot understand how you could have problems on the day the elections are supposed to hold when you have had all this time and you have been given all the resources available that you had asked for. You have all the staffing, all the logistical material that you need, and yet you have reasons to postpone the election. See, every time you have an election postponed in a place like Nigeria, people start thinking, is it just logistical or is it something else?
Yes.
You know, so that is what creates tension around the country with voters. And I tell you, Nigerian supporters of both parties are very, very emotional and very strong in their belief in the systems.
Aliyu, there is an American saying that if it isn't broken, you don't fix it.
You don't fix it, right?
Any particular reason, sincerely, why we are not talking about Professor Atahiru Jega here?
Well, people always remember Atahiru Jega has placed himself in history of Nigerian political system because of the way he handled the elections back in 2015. He also was under a tremendous amount of pressure on numerous times, you know, to do this or that. Every faction of the political divide wants you to do things differently. You know, right now, the ruling party chairman is accusing INEC of siding with Atiku, and Atiku is accusing INEC of siding with APC. So everybody, I mean, INEC is right in the middle of this situation, you know, and that is what normally happens. But I think the difference between Jega and Mahmoud Yakubu is that both of them, you know, Jega was, you know, an academician, so is this guy also.
Right.
But I have to tell you that both of them have really tried to remain steadfast, you know, under the circumstances.
At least let me ask you a question. This is a general question, really, that pretty much it talks about holding elections in Africa, elections that are considered really to be free, fair, credible, and verifiable. What do you really think needs to be done in order for that to happen? So that the average person in Africa, really, the average voter, has confidence in their institutions, that the institutions, at the end of the day, will deliver, and they will deliver something that reflects the will of the people.
If I take example of Senegal, I think we don't say that much, but the transparency of the process. And then the media, because in Senegal, I remember when Abdou Diouf
lost the power in 2000, the day of the elections, whatever result was published
right.
in the local bureau, local radios, everybody has the right to put it on the air and publish it.
Mm-hmm.
Before the end, even of the counting, by only listening to the radios,
mm-hmm.
you knew what was the real result in Washington, D.C., in Arlington, everywhere.
There was transparency.
And that you don't have it even in Congo. They just changed government last week in DRC, Democratic Republic of. It is said that it is only the Electoral Commission, radios, TVs don't have the right to publish the result coming out of the Bureau of Vote, local vote. And I don't see that also in the country of Mr. Sassou Nguesso, where she was ambassador. You don't have the right to do that.
The former Congo
so
Brazzaville.
So you will arrive at a situation where when people cast their vote and the result is somebody else who published it and nobody can contradict him. What happened in DRC, you see, in December, the radios were not allowed to publish whatever was there. So the Electoral Commission decided, okay, Mr. Felix Tshisekedi won, and the other guy is saying the contrary. And it's the same in Uganda, your own country. You don't have the right, the local radios, private radios, and papers, to publish what how people voted in Kampala or in any other city, Entebbe, because there is a guy there for 33 years, and he wants to stay there. There is no transparency in holding election in most of African countries.
In most of those countries that you mentioned, aren't you sure that they are challenged with the issue of lack of freedom, for example, of expression?
Well, who could challenge them?
What do you mean, who could challenge them?
Who's challenging Mr. Museveni? If you challenge him, he put you in jail.
He's
challenging Mr. Denis Sassou Nguesso.
But
you challenge him, you go to jail.
But why does he, Mr. Museveni or Mr. Sassou Nguesso, why does he have to do that? Because where does he, in fact, get the mandate to do that? Because he, the last time I checked, those two are supposed to be servants of their people.
Well, it's technically, yes. You know that better than me. Technically, they are supposed to take care of their population. But that is not the case. You know that better than me. We can talk here, but they are the officials.
So how can we bring about a paradigm shift?
Well, I think the paradigm is changing because she just said that the youth. And you're going to have a lot of change.
But the youth
Africa.
Operate in an environment that is obviously controlled by some forces, somebody.
But you know, the U.S., France, all those former colonies, they prefer having stability than sometimes changes.
So what is stability? Are you talking about the absence of war, absence of violence, or without, in fact, the presence of social, economic, political justice for everybody?
Well, I think it's not the agenda for many developed countries.
Well, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. There's no democracy in Studio 47. If the producer says go, you go. And on that note, today's guests were Ambassador Robin Rene Sanders, Aliyu Mustafa, and Idris Farr. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Grace Aliheru Abdu and Sarwa Jafari. Thanks to our audience for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta, Nigeria and Senegal. And please remember to keep the African voice alive.